Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Marjorie Silverman and Bessie Hyman are interviewing Dr. Harvey Thorpe on December 27th as on a return visit at his home at Aylesboro Avenue. Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Marjorie Silverman and Bessie Hyman are interviewing Dr. Harvey Thorpe on December 27th, 1977, at his home on Aylesboro. This is the second visit.
When we were discussing my parents, which might be an addition. In my life, in our life in Libau, my mother spent most of the day with the children, and we would go for long walks in which she would tutor us in mathematics. Although she had very little school education, she had apparently acquired considerable skill in mental arithmetic. And so she would teach us addition and subtraction, mental arithmetic, multiplication, and simple division. We knew our tables rather well by the time we came to this country. I was then just before my 11th birthday, and my sister naturally was younger, so was my brother. My mother was a very social person, and she had a great many friends, and she kept in touch not only with her friends, but she kept in touch with her relatives abroad when we came to this country. And she even supported some of the relatives when, after the World War I, when their fortunes, which had been upper class, upper middle class, went down to lower middle class by virtue of the Soviets coming into power. Now in medical school, it was of course 4 years beyond the college, and we had a very intensive education in the first year. We dealt with the usual first year subjects such as anatomy, histology, and bacteriology, and biochemistry. In that year, I continued to work, and one of my friends who used to visit me while I was studying was Sam Rosenberg, the famous artist in Pittsburgh who taught at Tech later on. Sam Rosenberg enlisted in the Army about the same time that I did in the early 1917, and I remember seeing him off to Camp Lee, and although I just never had to leave Pittsburgh during the entire war.
After medical school, what did you do?
This is just my first year. Yes. I wanted to tell you. I took advantage of my summer so that I would continue in school and get extra training. So that in summer between summer of 1916, I took a course in special anatomy of the brain and central nervous system. In that course, we had to make a very large recapitulation of the entire nervous system. It was a map which was probably about 8 feet high and about 3 feet wide. And this map was taught us various nervous pathways. This map was subsequently put up as a model for the students that followed and took the course subsequently, hung in the laboratory of anatomy for a number of years. It was called the recapitulation of the central nervous system, as I mentioned. In the second year, the latter half of which was the beginning of 1917, America went to war with Germany. And I remember we were sitting in our pathology class in the early afternoon, and when war was declared and the paper was passed around for those who wanted to enlist, and the whole class enlisted at that time. It was World War I, of course. I continued working for Westinghouse throughout this period, and as I mentioned on the previous day, that my connection with Westinghouse ceased when we had to go into the hospital ordered by the Army Medical Service at the time of the First World War flu.
What hospital was it?
I was in the old Montefiore Hospital.
Who ordered you to go in?
The Army. And the school, of course, selected the hospitals for us. And we, of course, had a word. I mean, we could say where we prefer to go. We might be assigned somewhere mm-hmm. else. I finished medical school in early June 1919, and then went into the internship at the Montefiore Hospital, where I had already served a good many months beforehand during the influenza epidemic. And continued to work part-time as a sub-intern.
What kind of an internship did you take?
I took my regular internship in medicine, in surgery, and in laboratory work. At the last 4 months of the laboratory, that is of the work in the hospital, I was assigned to the laboratory, and a pathologist had resigned, and the hospital was left without a pathologist, and I was then given the job of pathologist at the laboratory while I was an intern. We had an excellent technician by the name of Ms. Berger, and we were able to carry on the work for the hospital, which at that time had about 50-odd beds. During our period of in the hospital, while the first few months in the hospital, a lady rushed into the emergency room and with a crying baby. And she told us the story that a seamstress had picked up the baby and hugged her, and from then on the baby continued to cry. The mother brought the baby home, undressed her, and found that the needle was sticking into the baby's abdominal wall. So she brought the baby over to the hospital, and when we undressed the little girl, the needle was gone, but you could just see it puckering up the skin in her abdominal wall. We decided that it was best to do to operate immediately and to find the needle then, because it would be lost. A chap by the name of, I'll give you his first name, Charles. He was a surgical resident. I was an intern, and I was a medical intern. And we got Betty Brown, who is the widow of old fellow that was the late president of the Copperwell Steel Company, B. before Frank Capra.
Raymer.
Yes, Betty married Braemer later. Betty Brown was a student nurse, but she was a real nurse, and she gave the anesthetic. No, I was giving the anesthetic. That's right. And she was around helping the Dr. Charles's first name, I won't give you his last name. He couldn't find the needle, and he lost his nerve, and so it was up to me to help out. So I turned the anesthetic over to Betty Brown, and she continued to pour the ether, and fortunately, my engineering gave me an idea of sticking a hemostat in and coursing it along the incision, and I struck the needle, and I grasped it in the middle. I brought another hemostat in and broke the needle in half and pulled the two halves out. We then sutured the abdomen, and the youngster got along all right. The next day we were called on the carpet for operating without calling a surgeon, but we explained to them that we got the needle out, and by the time the surgeon would have gotten to the hospital, the needle would have been lost.
What happened at the end of your sophomore year?
At the end of the sophomore year, I was assigned to the McKee Hospital to help with deliveries. And in my first session, I had never had surgical gloves on before. In putting on my gloves, I made an error in putting them on, and I was quite called down by the man in charge, and I said, "Well, I've never had gloves on before. Will you show me how you do it?" And he said, "You should have watched me." But he got and dressed me down pretty well. I watched him, and from then on, I had a great respect for how to put on surgical gloves so that they would remain sterile.
After your internship at Montpelier,
this
was during your college year, sophomore year.
Yes. Yeah. Now we're back to my
internship at Montpelier Hospital.
My internship was really an excellent internship. Among the staff members, Dr. Sains, K.I. Sains, Dr. Milton Goldsmith, Dr. Simon Siegman, Dr. Joseph Jackson, and later on Dr. Thomas Shue, among them also Dr. Max Weinberg, who was an excellent neurologist, who came back when he was discharged from the Army, and really put Pittsburgh on the map from the standpoint of neurology. He had spent some time at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Pittsburgh at that time had the old-style neurologist, but he brought back modern clinical neurology from New York. Dr. Max Weinberg was a very outspoken person, and he was pretty much responsible for urging the rest of the staff to request a new hospital to be built. He was a junior staffman. The senior staff man in neurology at that time was trying to think of the name of the man who had a clinic at the corner of
Mayor,
Dr. Ed Mayer. Yes, he was a psychiatrist and neurologist. I remember an interesting experience when a general practitioner was making rounds with us, and Dr. Mayer was looking into the eye grounds of a neurologic patient, and he described what he saw, and he let me look in after, and I looked in there. I had already had experience with the ophthalmoscope. Then the general practitioner took the instrument and turned the lights, shone it into in his own eye, and not into the patient's head, and described just what Dr. Mayer saw from memory, not from what he mentioned. These are some of the interesting experiences. I might tell you one of the experiences that happened in the obstetrical room. We had a very excellent course at the McGee Hospital in obstetrics and deliveries. And one evening, I was called up to help a general practitioner with the delivery of the of a baby. Well, the baby's head was very slow in coming down, and well, he grasped a pair of forceps. And he said, let me show you how to deliver this baby with the forceps. And he put the forceps in the wrong way. And I called his attention to it. And he couldn't deliver the baby because the curve of the forceps was in the opposite direction of the pelvis. So I protested. He tried, but he couldn't deliver it. And then he turned to me and he says, you go ahead. And I said, no, I won't unless you take the forceps out. So he removed the forceps with considerable difficulty. And by that time, the baby's head came out by itself. So it saved me from embarrassing him.
Well, after your internship, where did you go?
After my internship, there was a chap by the name of Cohen, was also an intern with us. Cohen and I decided that we would go down to West Virginia for a week or so and rough it in the hills of West Virginia. We had an idea as to where to go because one of my relatives, who had come to this country about 4 or 5 years previously, had been a peddler in that area. And he told us, he went with us, and we went to one of the logging areas. When we got to the logging camp, we were told that there was an epidemic of chicken pox. And when we looked at some of the cases, it was smallpox. And so the doctor had asked us to look at that, and we suggested that he call in the state trooper's doctor because we had just taken our examinations. We weren't licensed in West Virginia anyhow. And we wouldn't receive our medical license for another month. So he called a state doctor in, and it was pronounced to be smallpox. It was an epidemic of smallpox, which was unrecognized. Fortunately, we had ourselves been vaccinated not too long previously, and they had quite a vaccination session in that logging town. He then asked us to see another case in consultation, and here was a little youngster that was wrapped in mustard and had convulsions. And we asked about the history, and here the youngster had fallen on his head off the swing and had the convulsions wrapped in mustard, and we told him that we thought that the mustard had really helped considerably, and we ought to now wipe the mustard off the youngster's body. And fortunately, the convulsions subsided just about that time. We left for the mountains further, and on our way back, the youngster was well, but the doctor, who was quite addicted to alcohol, with his pictures. On our way down through the mountains, we were accosted by some of the mountaineers, and we went up to some of the cottages, and there were women chewing snuff. The men were chewing snuff tobacco too. But the reason we were accosted was because they suspected us of being revenue agents. And we were walking along the railroad tracks when they accosted us. It was a narrow gauge railroad. We ate with the lumberjacks, and it's surprising what the diet of the lumberjacks consisted of. Of very large hunks of meat, which each man devoured at least a pound of boiled beef and potatoes. They needed that because the lumberjacks needed a calorie intake of about 5,000 calories, whereas the average person in life who is quite active requires no more than 3,000 calories.
When you came back from that vacation, did you take a residency or?
As soon as I got back from West Virginia, Dr. Weinberg and I went down to New York. He introduced me at the Mount Sinai Hospital, where he had was known, and I got a job as a resident at the New York Mount Sinai Hospital.
And what did you take a residency?
I took a residency in ophthalmology. While I was there, there was a very famous, there were two very famous ophthalmologists in charge. One was a man by the name of Charles May. He was a very benign and pleasant teacher. He had invented an electric ophthalmoscope. He had written a book on ophthalmology that was used in the medical schools. And then I had another chief, and his name was Carl Koller. Carl Koller, when he was a young man, had discovered cocaine anesthesia while he was at Heidelberg in Germany, and came over to America, and he became one of the chiefs at the Mount Sinai Hospital.
Why did you choose ophthalmology?
I chose ophthalmology for an interesting reason. That when I was in medical school, I was frequently lectured to the optometrists. My father, as you remember, was an optometrist. And I would lecture to them on anatomy, and the anatomy of the eye, and some of the brain. In my junior year in high school, an ophthalmologist who had transferred his domicile from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh stopped in my father's store to have a watch repair. And he saw me there, and he became interested in me, and asked me if I would come down and work in the Pittsburgh Free Clinic. And I worked after school, while I was in high school. After school, I worked with him, and I became quite interested in ophthalmology.
How many years was your residency?
My residency at Mount Sinai was a year. Then I went on to the Herman Knapp Memorial Hospital, which was a branch of Columbia University, and I continued my training there with Professor Knapp, who was head of the Department of Columbia.
How many years?
That was another year. And then I spent a time at the New York Pioneer Infirmary and at the Neurological Institute in New York, getting training in neuro-ophthalmology and in working with observing, watching Dr. Wheeler, who subsequently operated on the King of Siam. He was an outstanding surgeon, and he was the professor at Bellevue University and Bellevue Medical College, which was a branch of New York University. During that time, we I took additional courses. One of the outstanding courses I had in my entire career was at Cornell University Medical College. There, I studied pathology of the eye with a man by the name of Bernard Samuels, and studied embryology of the eye with a man by the name of Charles Stockard. Charles Stockard was a pioneer in experimental embryology and in embryology and in comparative anatomy of the eye. So we had an opportunity there to learn about the eye from its earliest conception in the unicellular animals, which have a pigment dot which serves as an eye, and because it causes the animal to respond to light, some of the amoeba have that. And then we went on to the various other animals in evolution, and studied the eyes in insects, in the eyes in snakes, in alligators, then in the mammals, also in rodents, and we found that we subjected a pregnant rabbit early in the pregnancy to alcohol fumes, that the baby rabbit might be born with only one eye or with two stunted eyes. So this now is coming out in the TV. The other night I heard where pregnant women were advised not to drink alcohol because it might affect the development of their child's brain. But with this we learned about more than 50 years ago. I'm going to figure this out.